Good morning, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, planning continues to come together for Findlay's proposed microtransit system. We'll get an update on the progress of this effort and what needs to happen next in order to bring it to fruition. Also this morning, to your health, muscle tremors are one of the most common and well-known effects of Parkinson's disease, but the two don't always go together. And speaking of Parkinson's happening around town, growing hope in the fight against a disease that impacts thousands of families, the Hancock County Parkinson's Network is holding their annual tulip bulb sale. We'll get details. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, July 29th, 2026. Do you sleep with the fan on? Maybe it's a ceiling fan. Maybe it is a box fan or, you know, oscillating fan in the bedroom, you know, whatever it might happen to me. Do you have to have the fan on? My wife and I are like that. We have to have the fan on. And it's just, I guess, the movement of the air, whatever. But this was interesting. I saw this on the Newswire. Sleeping with a fan running may seem like a solution to, you know, stagnant air that gets, you know, kind of warm in the bedroom. But doctors warn that it comes with side effects. I tell you what, every day we've got to have some doom and gloom story, right? Something that is we have to be worried about or fearful of. And, you know, we're all doomed. We're all going to die. Something that we're doing wrong. We're hurting our health. Here is another one of those things now doctors are saying is we can't have, not supposed to have a fan running while we're sleeping. It comes with side effects. Circulating allergens combined with dryness can worsen coughing, wheezing, and congestion. Can actually make things worse. Cool air concentrated on one area of the one part of the body can also tense up your muscles, causing stiffness or a sore neck. So if you've ever woke up in the morning and had a stiff back or sore neck, maybe it's not how you were sleeping. It's the fact that you were sleeping with a fan on it, apparently. Dry air also paralyzes nasal immune defenses, allowing allergens to linger longer. Dry skin and eye irritation are additional concerns. Man, I tell you, they're just running through a laundry list of concerns, all because you had the fan running at night. To reduce those risks, experts recommend pointing the fan away from your head, cleaning the blades regularly. Have to admit that we're not as diligent about that as maybe we should. Maintaining indoor humidity between 30 and 50% will also help. Fans cause no long-term damage, but emphasize, they say that they move the air. The fans move the air. Fans don't actually cool the air per se, but they do move it around. And many of us find that soothing, but it does come with risks. So I got to be worried about that. That's what we are worried about today. The fans running at night. They're not saying don't do it. They're just saying, you know, be aware there are risks. All right. All right. So this I thought was really fascinating because you might think that in 2026, high-speed internet is pretty much a universal thing. Right? Everybody's got high-speed internet in 2026, but that is still not the case. Where you live, says your new report, where you live still largely determines whether you have access to high-speed internet and how reliable that internet is, or, you know, what kind of speeds we're talking about. And in some states, the gap between the best connected neighborhoods and the rest of the state is as big as it has ever been. CompareInternet.com, which is a platform that, as the name implies, compares internet services, they built out what they call the 2026 State Internet Index They scored all 50 states, as well as Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico, using the FCC's own broadband data collection, which is the federal government's location-by-location record of where internet providers report offering services and what speeds they provide. So they compiled all of this data, and they find that Alaska ranks last in the nation on every single metric that they measured. High-speed access, fiber access, which fiber is much faster than traditional like cable internet or what have you. So fiber is like the holy grail of high-speed internet access. So they scored availability. That gigabit speed and the urban-rural gap, because as you might expect, in urban areas where there's a much higher concentration of people, there's generally better internet access because the internet providers go where the people are. And in rural areas, it's still kind of hit and miss. So Alaska ranks last, which is probably not a surprise. That said, 71.5% of people in Alaska still have access to high-speed internet. So dead last is 71.5%. So using that as the benchmark, North Dakota residents actually have the best home internet in the country, which kind of surprised me. They scored overall 94.1 out of 100, and just a one-point gap between city and country access. Because there's a fair part of North Dakota that's still very rural, but they do very well at connecting even rural areas in that state. But the real surprise is that states like Wisconsin and California were among the bottom 10. They have the biggest gap between rural and urban areas in terms of access and speed and all of that. California, actually. Which, at first glance, that's really surprising. But remember, California has a lot, especially Eastern California. They've got large expanses of desert and, you know, spread out population. I mean, yeah, big concentration in like Southern California and around the San Francisco area. But in other parts of that very large state, people are much more spread out. It's in the bottom 10. Ohio, incidentally, ranks 34th, scoring 64.1 out of 100 overall, while 92.8% of Ohioans have access to high-speed internet. The gap between rural and urban residents is pretty significant in the Buckeye State, 97.8% to 76.9%. So a pretty big drop-off when you get into the rural areas in terms of internet speeds and access. Availability of high-speed internet. Kind of interesting there. A couple of other items. Among the first things that you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. We have talked about this in the past. The great wealth transfer. You remember hearing about this? You will hear these stories in the news occasionally about the great wealth transfer, the much anticipated transfer of accumulated wealth from baby boomers to their heirs as the baby boom generation gets older and sadly passes on. They are passing on their wealth to the next generation. At least that was the anticipation, but this is now hitting a serious obstacle, it says. A new analysis reveals that soaring long-term care costs are rapidly depleting the savings of older Americans. Federal survey data shows that the share of people dying with nothing nearly doubled between 2006 and 2022. It was 6% of people pass away with nothing, no assets, nothing to pass on to the next generation. Now that's up to 11%. Annual nursing home bills often reach $75,000 to $130,000 annually. Annually, and that's just wiping out all of this wealth that they've accumulated over their lifetime. With Medicare rarely covering long-term care, families are selling homes and draining savings. Many then face Medicaid estate recovery rules that reclaim remaining assets, including the family home. wealthy families will survive this, they say, but middle-class families likely won't. So if you are anticipating a windfall or even inheriting the family home from your parents when they pass on, think again, is basically what this story says. The great wealth transfer may not be so great after all. And lastly here, among the first things you need to know this morning, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. What a crazy story this is. Really jumped out at me when I saw this on the Newswire. A sailor from California is recovering after spending about a month drifting at sea. Did you hear about this story? This is amazing. Keiichi Sato left Catalina Island on June 7th. He was going to row to Hawaii by himself, solo row, in a rowboat by himself. He was going to row from Catalina Island to Hawaii. Now, if you're thinking, what a crazy idea that is, yeah, it is. 2 weeks in, the mast on his boat broke, and the phone that he was using for navigation stopped working. He then tried to turn around and get back to California with his backup motor on his boat, but his boat ran out of fuel. So, nix on that idea. He says he was taken south by the current and kept drifting off course, although he really had no idea how far off course or no way to track it because his navigation device, his navigation phone, stopped working. He was also running out of drinking water. He survived on condensation, oatmeal, and on fish and squid that landed in his boat. All of this while he is trying to improvise repairs to his boat so that he could get somewhere. Just get me off the water. The crew aboard a cargo ship found Mr. Sato on July 21st. So remember, he left June 7th. On July 21st, he was finally found about 900 miles from Hawaii. They brought him on board, provided him with food and water and clothing and a room before getting back to land. So, wow, what an adventure. I'm guessing he's probably not in a hurry to repeat that anytime soon. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get. So complaining about how your week has gone. It could certainly be worse. Count your blessings, no matter how bad your week is. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Mostly sunny today with a high around 80, just a few clouds tonight, low in the 60s. The cyclosporiasis outbreak continues to affect people across the country, especially here in Northwest Ohio.
The foodborne parasite has sickened more than 4,000 people across the United States. At least 300 have been hospitalized. A new CBS News poll finds 40% of Americans say they are buying or eating less produce. 47% say they have little or no confidence in the FDA to deal with this outbreak.
The Toledo Lucas County Health Department is now reporting more than 2,600 cases in Northwest Ohio.
WTOL 11, Sophia Paraconi and Heather Pauloff reporting. The Findlay Police Department has announced the promotion of Officer Casey Schrader to the rank of sergeant. Sergeant Schrader is a graduate of Mohawk High School and holds a bachelor's degree in law enforcement and corrections and a master's in justice administration from Tiffin University. Sergeant Schrader began her law enforcement career with the Findlay Police Department in August of 2018. During her tenure with the department so far, Sergeant Schrader has served in a variety of roles, including field training officer, crisis management team operator, recruitment team member, and leader of the critical incident stress management team. Sergeant Schrader and her husband Matt have two children. Sergeant Schrader was sworn in by Mayor Christina Mern at the Findlay Municipal Building. See pictures from the swearing-in ceremony and this story on our website. The dedication ceremony has been set for the new Arlington Local School. It'll be held Saturday morning at 10 at the entrance off of Powell Drive. Arlington Heart and Soul says they're counting down the days until the dedication of the new Arlington Local School, and that there will also be a viewing of a school documentary at 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. Get more details in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news online anytime at WFIN.com.
So it was almost exactly 6 months ago that we first talked about this, and planning continues to come together for Findlay's proposed microtransit system. So we want to get an update on the progress of this effort and what needs to happen next in order to bring it to fruition. And once again, we are joined by CAC President CEO Josh Anderson and Director of Transportation Services Jamie Baker. And thank you both for taking the time once again. We appreciate it. I know there has been some big news on this in the past week or so, so I want to get to that. But first, for the benefit of those who maybe aren't familiar about what this is, give us a bit of a background. What is the microtransit system for Findlay and Hancock County as you have it kind of envisioned here?
What it is, it's a kind of a different service structure than we're currently doing. Right now, we're doing demand response transportation, scheduling folks in a two-week window of time. This microtransit plan will allow us to provide more transportation to the community. Right now, we're pretty much maxed out with our transportation. The demand has outstripped our ability to provide the transportation because so many people are asking for transportation in the city. Our rides are $2 each in the city and between $4 and $6 in the county. And that's a key for a lot of people to get to work and get to medical appointments and things. So the microtransit plan is we're going to beef up our software so people can schedule rides online. It's also going to help maximize our schedules, make them more efficient. Right now, we're doing a lot of trips all the way across town, which takes a lot of time and eliminates the ability for some people to get transportation. So with this enhanced software and scheduling, we're going to be able to do more transportation. The idea, one of the ideas is to split the city into zones and pick up everybody in the zones, take them to a central transfer point, and then take them to the zones they're going to be in, their final destination.
So
that's going to allow us to provide more transportation.
So this is closer to like a fixed point system, a traditional bus transit system, mass transit system that we're familiar with in bigger cities, but not quite that. It's kind of a hybrid between what you're doing now and what would be considered a mass transit system. That's kind of the idea, right?
Yeah, I consider it a kind of a hybrid. We're not going to have fixed routes like they have in the larger cities. There were some concerns with that. There were cost concerns. There were concerns with Findlay losing its small town feel, which I totally understand that a lot of people would feel seeing large buses on the streets. So this will allow us to provide more transportation, kind of doing what we're doing now with technological upgrades.
And more efficiency. So as we mentioned, you just got a grant approved for a grant on this that would help make this happen. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, the grant that we received is actually it's part of our ongoing funding that allows us to operate our program as it currently stands. However, the big difference this year is that we had a tremendous amount of local support, financial local support. Five key players, including the City of Findlay, the Hancock County Commissioners, the Blanchard Port Authority, and the Community Foundation came together. Recognized the value of transportation and provided an additional amount of local matching funds that we didn't have in the past. Local matching funds are the key to a rural public transit program. Without the local funding commitment, you can't unlock the federal funds. And it's always the most difficult part about sustaining the program. So with these extra funds, it gave us the capacity we needed to apply for this reimagined service that we hope to provide. And so part of this grant also includes some funding that allow us to consult with transportation experts that have helped other organizations like ours move from the current demand responsive state to a microtransit system. And so we've signed that contract. We're starting to work with the consultants, and it's really going to be fast tracked, hopefully between now and the end of the year, with the hope of a full implementation, or at least the initial stages of implementation on the ground in early 2027.
And that was actually where I was going with this. I guess before we talk about what happens next, I should mention, you in talking about funding, does this put you where you need to be completely in terms of funding for this, or is there still funding that is needed? Are you seeking additional support at the local level, that kind of thing?
We're always looking for additional local support. The other piece of the pie, if you will, in terms of generating local match, is fee-for-service contracts. So Jamie and his team basically have a social enterprise. They go out to the market and say, hey, we have these resources, and find buyers, if you will, that need transportation services. And the revenue generated through those activities also goes into the local match. However, Like the nature of most contracts, there's ebbs and flows. And so the more public commitment we can get, more fixed, the more sustainable this microtransit project will be. So that's a very long-winded way of saying we're always looking for more local commitments.
Can never have too much, I suppose. So what does happen next? I mean, Josh, you're talking about some of the things that are next up in order to, on the checklist in order to make this happen. But kind of take us through what will happen now that you have at least the majority of the funding secured. So where do you go from here?
Absolutely. So we're working with Nelson Nygaard on our microtransit implementation plan. Right now, we're gathering the data for them so they can look at the data to see how best we can implement this. We're also looking at various software vendors, seeing who might be the best fit for what we want to do, because it's an ever-evolving the software with AI these days and all the advancements. It's an ever-evolving thing with our transit dispatching and scheduling software, making it better and more efficient. It's grown by leaps and bounds, so we're seeing who might be the best vendor for our for this project. So they're going to get all the information. I'm gathering a lot of data right now, a lot of rider data, where people are going, where we're picking people up at, what times they need transportation, and we're going to look at all that data with our consultants and come up with a plan. And like Josh said, hopefully for some implementation sometime in the first quarter. We're also waiting on 5 low floor vehicles that we're going to use in this. We got the funding from the county commissioners, the community foundation, and the city of Findlay to buy these 5 low floor vehicles that are easy on, easy off for those with mobility issues. They're 16 passenger vehicles, so they can carry more people. If we pick people up in zones, pick 5, 6, 7 people up in a zone and take them to a transfer station. And so we're waiting on those. And once we get those and the implementation plan is complete, hopefully we can get started on the project in the first quarter next year.
That's one of the other things I was going to ask in terms of equipment. Procuring new equipment or additional equipment, does that mean the current vehicle is going to be retired, or is this add to the fleet?
Some of the vehicles will be retired. We are running some vehicles that have already 250,000 miles on it. So we
some
will
of them
be,
are new.
Yes, we will be dispositioning several vehicles. But, that way we're getting away from typically our vehicles use lifts for people with trouble getting into the buses. And this will help eliminate some of that. There's, lifts break down. You never want to take people off the ground, and it's, the danger factor, the safety factor is key. So these vehicles will go a long way to help us. be more efficient too, because getting people on and off the bus will be a lot quicker as well.
Is this going to require additional personnel, more drivers? And so, I mean, you know, what are you going to have to expand and, you know, looking at growing the service? I would imagine that involves recruitment of additional drivers, that kind of thing.
Absolutely, Chris. We are always looking for new drivers. If you know anybody, we have a lot of retired folks that like to drive for us. So, you know, it's a good second income for folks. And, you know, you're helping your community. And we're always looking for good people to join our staff. We have a lot of great people right now. And we're always looking for more good people. So we're always looking for drivers, just like every business in Findlay is looking for employees right now.
Yeah. So. And so you mentioned that the goal is still to launch this late this year or early next year, correct?
In first quarter of next year.
Okay.
The implementation plan will probably take until the end of the year, I would imagine.
And in the meantime, the traditional HATS service is still available. Is that going to be available once this launches, or will this be the structure for all of your transportation services locally?
Well, this will be the structure for our transportation services in Hancock County. There will not be much of a change in Wyandotte or Hardin counties, where we also provide public transportation. Mm-hmm. But in Hancock County, I mean, people will still be able to call our dispatchers, talk to them, let them know what they need, and the dispatchers can help them over the phone. Or if they choose, they'll have an app to use, and they can just do it all online. So,
and Josh, let me ask you, with respect to your full service area, as you mentioned, is more than Hancock, also Hardin, Wyandotte, and Putnam County, hence the name HHWP CAC. Are you looking at the success of this as sort of a test case to perhaps expand that into some of those other areas as well?
Of course. You know, again, we're always looking at ways, how do we maximize our efficiency? How do we provide more services with similar or very minor addition to resources? Mm-hmm. We're always looking at ways. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about stretching these public funds as far as we can and providing the most high quality services as possible. So, yes, in our other two counties at this point, which are Wyandotte and Hardin, we would certainly look at this model. There's a lot of local input, of course. And so, you know, even though we're a small, relatively small regional rural area, I think most people in the area understand that the culture in Wyandotte and Putnam and Hancock and Hardin, there's differences. And mm-hmm. so, and the needs are different. So,
right.
Yes, of course, would it look exactly like we plan on the way the design is set up to be in Hancock County? Probably not. But you know me, Chris, by now, I love to give long answers. The short answer is yes. Anything we can do in these other counties to improve efficiency, we will be exploring and possibly using this as a good model to start with.
Again, CAC President and CEO Josh Anderson and Director of Transportation Services Jamie Baker with us this morning. An update on this new proposed microtransit system that continues to evolve and develop. Looking forward to launching at some point next year, and I'm sure we'll check in again with an update. In the meantime, thank you both for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Chris, thanks so much for having us. We appreciate it, and we love talking about transportation. Have us back anytime.
Well, to your health this morning, muscle tremors are one of the most common and well-known effects of Parkinson's disease, of course, but the two don't always necessarily go together. Separate from Parkinson's is something called essential tremor. It is a progressive movement disorder affecting millions of people worldwide that can involve uncontrollable shaking of the hands, the head, or other parts of the body, interfering with daily activities, and obviously having a significant impact on quality of life. Joining us this morning joining is essential tremor patient Ruth Essler, as well as her physician and movement disorder specialist, Dr. Philip Tipton, who is also a paid consultant for Boston Scientific. Ruth, let me start with you. Tell us a little bit about your journey with this essential tremor.
Sure. What started out as minor shaking of the hands got progressively worse. I was later diagnosed with essential tremors, and initially brain surgery was mentioned, but I decided it was not an option. As the tremors worsened and impacted my job, it was time to look at other options.
Yeah. And Dr. Tipton, I would imagine that Ruth's aversion to brain surgery is probably not unique among patients who are confronted with this. Talk a little bit about working with Ruth and with your other patients to find treatment options that are alternatives that will work for the other patients.
Yeah, well said. Ruth's story is probably pretty familiar to millions of Americans battling essential tremor. As you mentioned earlier, this is a condition that involves shaking of virtually any body part, but particularly the hands. And so it can interfere with day-to-day activities like eating and writing and drinking. Now, fortunately, we have several therapy options for essential tremor. We've got oral medications. Ruth tried those. We also have injections to provide a benefit for tremor of the head. But Ruth tried those as well. And like many, once she wasn't getting the benefit that she was looking for, we began to discuss more advanced options, that being deep brain stimulation, or DBS. Now, DBS is a therapy that involves providing an electrical signal to the brain through an electrode that's connected to an implanted device called a stimulator. And when we provide that electrical signal, we're able to improve movement symptoms such as tremor.
Now, Ruth, I know, as you mentioned, you know, you're not necessarily big on the idea of brain surgery. When you heard about this type of therapy, that can be a little scary as well, providing, you know, like electrical stimulations deep in the brain. That maybe sounds a little scary as well. But talk a little bit about the impact that this has had on your life and your management of this condition.
Well, sure. Probably the most notable part and the best part and the most emotionally exciting part was after the procedure, the impact was immediate. I was able to wave my hands up in the air and make them straight, and they weren't shaking. So that is probably the best. I was elated on that.
And Dr. Tipton, with this deep brain stimulation or DBS therapy, is who is a good candidate for this? Is this something that anyone who finds themselves diagnosed with this condition should consider, or are there certain other considerations to go along with this? Kind of lay this out.
Yeah, roughly half of patients with essential tremor don't get the kind of mileage that they're looking for from typical tremor medications. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, it's important to have a discussion with your physician about the risks and benefits of DBS and whether or not it's the right option for you.
What does that conversation look like for those who may be facing a diagnosis and want to know, you know, what comes next? And I guess I'll actually kind of throw this out for both of you. What should those conversations with the doctor look like? And Ruth, what would you say to somebody who is just getting this diagnosis and wondering what comes next?
Sure. Well, one, I would say don't wait the 2 years that I waited. And two, to talk to your physician. It was sitting down with Dr. Tipton and my husband going, and he spent a long time going through the entire procedure and, you know, answered all of our questions. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, those are the two things that it was that day that we committed to moving forward after our discussion with Dr. Tipton.
And Dr. Tipton, what should a patient, what questions should they ask?
I think having a good expectations conversation with your physician has to happen. Understanding what are the expected benefits and, frankly, what are the risks associated with the procedure. And if we, as the treating team and the patient, come together to decide if that potential benefit outweighs the risk, then it's a viable therapy for you. Another place that you can learn more about deep brain stimulation is at dbsandme.com. You can learn more about the Boston Scientific System and what makes it different, as well as the general indications, precautions, and risks with DBS.
To your health this morning, Ruth Esler, Dr. Philip Tipton, thank you very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
A man in Idaho has claimed a new Guinness World Record for juggling flaming torches on a unicycle. But it wasn't easy. David Rush, who was already a multi-record holder in both unicycling and juggling, apparently decided that if he could do both separately, he should be able to do both simultaneously. He quickly discovered, however, a hidden danger. The forward momentum of the unicycle creates a draft that blows the flaming torches directly into the juggler's face. Well, yeah, that would be a problem. His first attempt cost him his eyebrows and some of his hair. But undeterred, he pressed on, and once he found his rhythm, Guinness was able to certify and confirm his title of 175 consecutive catches, more than quadrupling the previous record of 37. It only cost him his eyebrows and his hair. Oh my, now that is dedication right there. That is dedication to your craft. Speaking of circus acts, a circus performer in Wallkill, New York, was struck in the neck by an arrow during a live show at the Orange County Fair recently. The incident occurred when one performer fired an arrow toward a foam target held by Edwin Rangel during the crossbow sharpshooter act. But as it turns out, this shooter wasn't so sharp after all. This is like the most predictable accident. You've got a guy holding the target that someone is shooting an arrow at. What could possibly go wrong? Well, the arrow missed its mark and hit Mr. Rangel, catching him in the corner of his neck. He was airlifted to a hospital in stable condition. The arrow was removed and he was released. That is amazing. I mean, that could have been much, much different, but thank goodness he's going to be okay. I guess the ringmaster said there wasn't even any blood. It was crazy. And in an equally bizarre story of impalement, a man in Montana is recovering after being impaled by his own hiking pole while climbing Granite Peak. David Cifaldi, I think is how you pronounce his name. He was climbing the mountain with two friends when he slipped on some rocks. Once he steadied himself and stood back up, he noticed that his hiking pole had pierced the side of his body. Ouch! Drawing on his medical training as a nurse, Mr. Cifaldi determined that the wound was not immediately life-threatening, but obviously he needed to get to a hospital. And figuring that it would probably be more dangerous to remove the pole, the group turned back and hiked over 10 miles across rugged terrain to safety, all with the pole sticking out of his side. Can you imagine they're encountering other hikers on their way back down the mountain? Don't mind me, I've just got a pole in my side here. It was like 6 feet out from his side or whatever. That had to be awkward. After roughly 6.5 hours, the group reached the trailhead, and eventually Mr. Cifaldi was transferred to a local hospital in Billings, where doctors removed the pole, and he is going to be just fine. but he's got a story to tell. Hey, remember that time we tried to climb Granite Peak and you got a pole, impaled yourself with your hiking pole? My goodness. There you go. That is today's broken news report. An update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
You're invited to the Night Jazz Concert to benefit Flag City Honor Flight Sunday, August 2nd from 4:30 till 7:30 at 50 North, located at 339 East Melrose in Findlay. The concert is free, but donations will be accepted. Come out for food, raffles, music, and fun Sunday, August 2nd from 4:30 to 7:30 at 50 North as Night Jazz performs to benefit Flag City Honor Flight. Doors open at 3:30. This message provided by WFIN.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. A new study finds that American pet owners now spend an average of $4,272 annually on routine care for their furry family members. Over a typical 12-year lifespan, total costs can now exceed $50,000. Caring for our pets. Veterinary prices in the past 5 years have climbed roughly 43%, driven by advanced diagnostics, staff shortages, and round-the-clock care demands. Most basic ER estimates fall between $1,200 and $2,500 for emergency care for a pet. And in this same survey, they asked pet owners what they would be willing to do for their pets when faced with unaffordable bills. 38% of pet owners say they would charge their credit cards, and 20% say that they would be willing to drain their savings entirely to care for their pets. That's dedication right there. So, happening around town, with the slogan of Growing Hope, the Hancock County Parkinson's Network is holding their annual tulip bulb sale. And we are joined this morning by Linda DeArmond and Barb Matheny from the Hancock County Parkinson's Network. Ladies, thank you very much for taking the time this morning. First of all, talk a little bit about why a tulip bulb sale. Give us the story behind this.
Well, we are the Hancock County Parkinson's Network, and our mission and our objectives surround around supporting the Parkinson's community, both those who live with Parkinson's as well as their caregivers. Mm-hmm. And the international symbol for Parkinson's awareness is the red tulip. And so we decided that trying to have a planting of the red tulips around our community would show support for folks in the Parkinson's community and also draw attention to the work that we're trying to do. So you plant them in the fall and they bloom in April here in this part of the world. And that is Parkinson's Awareness Month. So it's just a really nice tie-in, both in the fall to be able to reach out to folks to bring awareness to the cause, but then also again in the spring during the blooming, which is also simultaneous to our Big Empower Walk, which occurs in April as well.
So talk a little bit about the Hancock County Parkinson's Network and the work that you do in support for individuals and families who are dealing with that here in Hancock County.
Well, first of all, we've been very blessed to have the support of the community through donations and sponsorships at our walk. So our walk has been extremely successful. It brings in over 300 people, and it's done that for the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. So there is a walk itself where people are recognized for having Parkinson's and given the support of families and friends. With that money, then, we've had a lot of opportunities to be able to support programs at both 50 North and at the YMCA, providing materials, training, equipment, new chairs for classes that are based with, you know, sitting in a chair. Mm-hmm. We've been able to bring in speakers, motivational speakers, providing books that when they have been an author of something that's very pertinent for people with Parkinson's. So that's been a wonderful opportunity to do that. We've been able to provide grants. This year, we launched a grant program And I'll let Linda talk about that because she's the head of that committee.
Yeah, we actually, as you know from talking to us, but just for your listeners, we started just as a community committee.
Yeah.
And then it became pretty clear after a while that if we really wanted to be able to make the kind of impact we wanted to, we would need to become a 501c3 so we can raise funds and have some resources to do programming. And so this is really our third year of existence, okay. And we are very proud of what we've been able to do, but we're also eager to be able to have outreach even more than ever. And one of the things with our fundraising through the walk is to provide a grant program where we set aside some money and we allow folks to apply and let us know about their ideas for programs and services that would help support the Parkinson's community. So we've been able to partner then with Awakening Minds Art. For example, they purchased adaptive equipment that would allow folks that have one of the typical symptoms with Parkinson's, which would be tremors. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe they were artists before, maybe they'd like to be artists, but their hand is fighting them. And so to be able to have some adaptive equipment, be able to have a class like that, that you could do with your caregiver, very important. We partnered with the hospital rehab center and they were able to purchase adaptive equipment for eating. You know, tremors also provide complications with being able to eat. That's both a nutritional problem. It's a pride problem. It's a social problem. Mm-hmm. And so they were able to purchase some utensils that help to control for the tremor and allow people to have some dignity during their meals and enhance their nutrition. So that was great. And 50 North has been a great partner. We've provided grant money for them to enhance their already robust Parkinson's exercise programs. And the jury is out. Barbara could do an entire day for you on the benefits of fitness and exercise to mitigating symptoms and being able to stave them off as long as possible and be as healthy and flexible as long as possible. So that's really great.
You know, you talk about the grant program, and that is absolutely fabulous, because how many times does it happen where you get presented with these ideas? Awakening Minds Art, I think, would be a perfect example where maybe you wouldn't have had that idea absent the grant program. You know, here's something that would have maybe not even crossed your radar.
Oh, you're 100% correct. You know, it allows them to grow their outreach into a whole different sector and allows us to reach the people that we want to target completely. So it's a great partnership. So we're trying to build some attendance at those classes. You know, there are some people that hadn't even really thought about art as an activity.
Yeah.
And so right now there's classes being held at 50 North. And we would like to encourage anybody that is in your listening audience that has a loved one with Parkinson's to explore that, because it's a great pastime. It's something you can do together, and the adaptive equipment lets them be able to do it as much as possible.
And real quickly, just to touch on this, when we talk about all of the programs that and resources that are available for those with Parkinson's, it's not just those who are diagnosed, but also their families as well, and supporting their loved ones with Parkinson's, like any disease, any condition, that's so very important.
It is, and helping to build their awareness, educate them and know what's possible, mm-hmm. and also offer them the support they need as the disease progresses. There is a support group out at 50 North is a great partner for us. So we would just like to say that as an entity, we have no bricks and mortar. We are an all-volunteer organization. We have somebody who helps us with a little administrative stuff, but other than that, you know, we are running on a shoestring, and 50 North provides a space and storage and also is very interested in providing services for the Parkinson's community. So that's been great.
So we mentioned the tulip bulb sale. Give us all of the details on this for those who hear us talk about and want to support this very worthwhile mission. The tulip bulb sale is a great way of doing that. Give us all of the details here.
Of course. Well, so we take orders for tulip bulbs, and we want to tell you they are magnificent, large tulip bulbs. The flowers are beautiful, and I can assure you of that because I have hundreds of them in my yard. And so we sell the tulip bulbs, and they're at an excellent price point because, honestly, Chris, this is not a fundraiser for us. This is an awareness builder and a low barrier way for people to be engaged. So you can buy a package of 25 for $20, 50 for $35, 100 for $65, and depends on how big your planting wants to be, whether you're a business and you want some, a really robust show, or whether you're an individual that just wants it smaller. For you, for those of you that maybe don't have a place or a green thumb, we also have garden flags that you that have our logo with the tulips that you can put out in the springtime that look very beautiful. And it's just a way, if you don't want to plant or that's not something that you can do where you are. And then you can go to our website, which is hcparkinsonsnetwork.org. And there is a link there to order the tulips online, and you can pay for them online. And then in the fall, when they arrive here in town, we have a pickup located at College First Church of God. October 22nd will be our pickup day.
Okay.
Between 4 and 6. And if you order more than 100, we deliver them to you, which is very easy. And so that works out. It's a really great system. And it also comes complete with directions on how to plant and care for them.
There you go. And the sale is happening now, correct?
Yes, it starts August 1, and we'll probably, press release goes out tomorrow.
Okay.
And it goes until the tulip bulbs are gone.
Okay. All right. Very good. We've got a link on our webpage so you can get more information and place your order there for the Hancock County Parkinson's Network Tulip Bulb Sale. Linda DeArmond and Barb Matheny with the Hancock County Parkinson's Network with us this morning. Ladies, thank you both for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. Have a great day.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Remember, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the program at our webpage. Check us out online at goodmornings.net. And once again, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would appreciate it if you haven't done it already, if you would leave us a rating, a review on your favorite podcasting platform to help others discover the show as well, help spread the word, and we appreciate that very much. Coming up tomorrow morning on the program, doctors and health experts are urging parents to make sure the kids are up to date on their vaccinations ahead of back-to-school season. Plus, now that we've stuffed the bus with school supplies, we'll get those distributed this weekend. Now it's time to outfit students with new clothes for the new school year, and Ohio Means Jobs has a program for that. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.